Hello.
Hi, guys.
Welcome back
to the Flick Chicks podcast.
I'm Jane.
And I'm Allison.
And how are you, Allison?
I'm good. We just finished recording a Patreon episode.
We did.
Which is out now.
Yep, ready or not.
If you're listening to this. It's a pretty good one, I think. It's an interesting film.
It is.
So coming up, we have
The Devil All the Time
on Patreon. And then we also finally,
got
a hold of Do the Right Thing.
Mm-hmm.
We finally are going to do that. We've been talking about it for months.
Yep.
We're actually going to do it.
We can never find it.
We can never find it for less than like $15. Well, I'll go ahead and just plug it. we found a Universal has a streaming service that's pretty new called Peacock.
Mm-hmm.
It's 100% free. We haven't watched anything on it yet. I do have an account. I did make an account.
Yeah.
But we haven't watched anything yet. But it's free. You don't need a card to sign up. And I'm guessing there's probably ads, but
I mean, and they have Do the Right Thing.
So. Yeah, they're the only streaming site that has Do the Right Thing.
Yeah, so we can watch it for free, which is great.
Yeah, so exciting. So we'll be doing that. How are you, Jane?
I'm good. It's finally cool outside. It was 55 this morning. It was great.
Yeah, I know. The high today is 75.
Beautiful.
So that's really nice.
Yeah, I'm very happy about that.
We do have a couple of patrons to shout out.
Gotta plug them.
One of these we are supposed to have done months ago, but we just kept forgetting. And one of them is new. So we want to welcome to our $5 Patreon tier, Hayden and Nathan.
Hayden and Nathan.
Thank you guys.
Thank you guys
for donating.
So much.
It really helps us.
It really does.
It helps us pay for things like HBO Max, which is so much of what we've been doing is on there.
Yeah.
And if you guys are interested and you're not already supporting us on Patreon, we do have one. The lowest tier is $1, and you get access to our entire back catalog, and then it goes up from there.
So if all you want is just to listen to our Patreon episodes, all you have to give us is $1.
Yes.
And then the more money you give us after that, the more you get.
You get shout-outs, you get priority listener pick, all of those kinds of things. We do a lot of listener picks on Patreon, especially if they're not. We try and do movies that have bigger names on here, and we do a little lesser known movies on Patreon.
Or newer movies.
But a lot of times that means that those, in my opinion, are generally more interesting episodes.
Yeah, I think so too.
Because, for example, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which is what we're talking about today, is a great film, everyone loves it, but also it can be a little bit hard to talk about films like that versus Ready or Not has a lot going on, it's new.
Yeah.
There's a lot to talk about because not everything's already been said about it.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
So definitely hop on over there.
Yes.
Who knows when those tiers will change.
Yeah, who knows?
Who knows if the price will go up.
We also curse more on that on Patreon.
We do.
We curse a lot more.
We don't care on Patreon.
Yeah. You're paying for it.
If you like the rants, Patreon.
Patreon.
$1 baby.
Anything goes.
Yeah, anything goes on Patreon. So, anyway, that's our Patreon plug. We haven't done one of those in a while.
I know, yeah. Figured we could plug that in.
Yeah. So, anyway, thanks, guys.
So today we're doing the classic 1975 film, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah.
In preparation for Ryan Murphy's new show, Ratched.
Yeah. Which will be interesting.
It will
and
be.
I'm excited to talk about this after we talk about this movie.
Me too.
Excited at the end to kind of talk about our thoughts on Ratched and what it will or will not be.
I wanted everyone, who hasn't seen One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest to kind of be able to just listen to this episode before they watch Ratched and kind of understand.
Which I want to say, if you haven't seen this movie, you should go see it.
You should go see it. It's incredible.
It's literally probably one of the best movies of all time.
Of all time.
Of
easily
all time.
Top 10.
I believe it's in the AFI's top 100.
I believe so too. It's it is one of the only three films have won the Big Five awards at the Oscars.
Yeah.
And it is one of those.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The other two are It Happened One Night. Which
and Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah. So that's 1930s and 1990s.
Yeah.
So. Anyway, let's get into this plot.
Yes.
Okay. In Oregon, in the fall of 1963, recidivist malefactor, Randall Patrick McMurphy is transferred to a mental institution after serving a few months on a prison farm on charges of assault and statutory rape of a 15-year-old girl.
Mm-hmm.
Though not truly mentally ill, McMurphy hopes to avoid hard labor and complete the remainder of his sentence in a more calm and relaxed environment. Upon arriving at the hospital, he finds the ward is being dominated by head nurse Mildred Ratched, a cold, passive-aggressive tyrant who uses her rules and authority to intimidate her patients into a restrictive, joyless existence.
Mm-hmm.
The other patients include anxious, stuttering 21-year-old Billy Bibbit, Charlie Cheswick, who is prone to childish fits and tantrums, delusional and innocent Martini.
I love Martini.
The articulate, repressed homosexual Dale Harding. Belligerent and profane Max Tabor. Epileptics Jim Seafelt and Bruce Fredrickson, the former of whom gives his medicine to the latter. Quiet but violent-minded Scanlan. Chief Bromden, a very tall Native American deaf-mute, though his disabilities are later revealed as a self-protecting charade.
Ooh.
And several others with more chronic conditions. Ratchet soon sees McMurphy's lively, rebellious presence as a threat to her authority. She confiscates the patient's cigarettes and rations them, and suspends their card-playing privileges. During his time in the ward, McMurphy finds himself in a battle of wills against the cunning and powerful, crazed nurse Ratchet. He steals a school bus, escaping with several patients to go fishing on the Pacific Ocean coast, encouraging his fellow patients to discover their own abilities and find self-confidence. Mm-hmm. After an orderly tells him that the judge's time sentence doesn't apply for people who are deemed to be criminally insane, McMurphy plans to escape, encouraging Chief Bromden to throw a hydrotherapy console through the window. It is also revealed that McMurphy, Chief, Cheswick, and Tabor are the only non-chronic patients staying at the institution.
They're the only ones that are there against their wills.
Yes. All the rest of them are self-committed and can voluntarily check out at any time, but are too afraid to do so. After Cheswick bursts into a fit demanding his cigarettes, which Nurse Ratchet had rationed due to patients losing all their money to McMurphy, McMurphy fights with the orderlies, and being overpowered 2-on-1, the chief asserts himself into the fight, lifting one of the orderlies off McMurphy. Nurse Ratchet sends Chief Cheswick and McMurphy to the shock shop as a result of this insubordination. Oh my god.
It's like the worst part of the movie for me is the electroshock scenes. Because, like, that would happen to me if I existed at this time.
Yeah,
like, that's
not good.
That would be me.
Yeah, you just have to keep a tight lip on that.
Forever. Exactly.
While awaiting their punishment, McMurphy offers Chief a stick of juicy fruit and discovers he can actually speak and hear, having feigned his deaf-muteness to avoid engaging with anyone.
It's such a great scene. He's like, you son of a bitch, Chief!
After being subjected to electroconvulsive therapy, McMurphy returns to the ward pretending to have brain damage, although he winks at the Chief, showing he is pulling a trick on the other patients. Mm-hmm. McMurphy breaks into laughter and reveals the treatment has made him even more determined to defeat Nurse Ratched. McMurphy and Chief make plans to escape, but decide to throw a secret Christmas party for their friends after Ratchet and the orderlies leave for the night. McMurphy sneaks two women carrying bottles of alcohol, candy, and rose into the ward and bribes the night guard Turkle to allow this. After a night of partying, McMurphy and Chief prepare to escape, inviting Billy to come with them. Not ready to leave the hospital, he refuses, but he asks for a date with Candy. McMurphy arranges for them to have sex with her. McMurphy and the others get drunk, and McMurphy drifts off instead of making his escape with Chief. Ratchet arrives in the morning to find the ward in disarray and most of the patients passed out drunk. She discovers Billy and Candy together and aims to embarrass Billy in front of everyone. Billy manages to overcome his stutter and stands up to Ratchet. Mm-hmm. But when she threatens to tell his mother, Billy cracks under the pressure and reverts to furious stuttering. Ratchet has him placed in the doctor's office to wait for the doctor to arrive. Moments later, McMurphy punches an orderly when trying to escape out the window with Chief, causing the other orderly to run back into the room and confront them, threatening them with brass knuckles. While this is happening, Billy commits suicide by slitting his throat with broken glass.
Oh,
it's horribly sad.
It's horrible.
Especially because all he has is a stutter. He's not even mentally ill at all.
Maybe anxiety because of the stutter.
Right. Stuttering is like something that is... It's not easily overcome, but absolutely can be and is overcome every day.
Definitely.
Like, 100% cured.
Yeah.
It's just through speech therapy.
It's just so sad. And then, like, in the 70s, everyone's like, or this would be the 60s, everyone's like, no, he's mentally ill.
I know, and you're like,
he just has a stutter.
Some fucking speech therapy.
It's literally, Chief is just in there because he's a quiet Native American.
Basically. Yeah. So anyway, McMurphy and the other patients see this, and McMurphy flies into a rage and begins strangling Nurse Ratched.
Yeah, very intense.
The orderlies apprehend McMurphy and pull him off Ratched, saving her life. Sometime later, Nurse Ratched is seen wearing a neck brace and speaking with a weak voice, losing her most important weapon in intimidating patients. And Harding now leads the now unsuspended card playing. McMurphy is nowhere to be found, causing rumors that he has escaped. Late that night, Chief sees McMurphy being returned to his bed. He greets him, elated that McMurphy had kept his promise not to escape without him, but notices that McMurphy is utterly unresponsive and physically limp, and discovers lobotomy scars on his forehead.
This is the scene where I, like, just choke up. I cry. It's horrible.
In an act of mercy, Chief says, "You're coming with me," and smothers McMurphy to death with a pillow. Kills him. He then lifts the hydrotherapy fountain off of the floor, throws it out the window, and escapes from the building. The end.
The end.
That's the end.
Oh, man. One of the most iconic endings of a film ever.
Literally so sad.
So sad.
Billy's death.
Oh, my God. Poor Billy. And Billy's, like, the sweetest.
So nice. He just wants to have sex with a girl.
And but he has a stutter, and he's like, "No one's ever going to have sex with me."
You're like, that's not even true. You're, like, a cute kid.
He was nominated for Best Supporting Actor.
He did amazing.
He was amazing as Billy Bibbit.
So sad.
I know.
The fact that his name's Billy Bibbit.
Billy Bibbit.
Just the worst name to have if you have a
stutter. Billy Bibbit.
Yeah, you're like, oh, that sucks ass.
Sucks so much. Oh, this is interesting, though. So the guard, the orderly, was also in The Shining. He played Dick in The Shining.
Right!
And with Jack Nicholson.
This is literally...
This is one of the saddest movies ever.
It's so good.
I want to know where it is on the list of the AFI Top 100. Because I know it's on there.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it is.
God,
it is sad.
It's ranked 33rd.
Wow. That's pretty high.
Yeah.
This movie kills me.
I know. It's freaking heartbreaking. I don't even know where to begin. So, this movie, it's interesting. So, I was super into, like, the Beat generation of, like, authors. So, like, Allen Ginsberg, Jack Kerouac, Ken Kesey, who wrote One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest. So, I read One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest in, like, ninth grade. I don't remember a lot of it, but I do remember it's very similar to the movie, except the fact that it is narrated by Chief.
Yes.
In the book.
There is, I do have an article pulled up on the AV Club where they talk about the differences between the book and the movie. So it does say the biggest difference between the book and the movie is obvious from the start. The novel is narrated by Chief, a half Native American mental patient who pretends to be deaf in order to avoid interacting with the outside world. Mm-hmm. Bromden's paranoid fantasies take center stage immediately, establishing a perspective full of metaphors made of literal and psychosexual racially tinged terror. Mm-hmm. It takes a page or two for the reality of the situation to sink in, and even then, the reader spends much of the first half of the book working to translate Bromden's fever dreams into a more level-headed narrative.
It's true.
The result is a voice that is never entirely comfortable and a story in which melodrama routinely threatens to explode into chaos. By contrast, the first scene of the film adaptation takes place outside the mental institution that will serve as the setting for most of what follows. Mm-hmm. We see fields and a forest in the early morning, a car coming along a road, and after a few minutes inside the ward, as the domineering nurse Ratchet arrives and the patients fall into morning routine, we cut back to the car pulling up outside the building and a man in a stocking cap and leather jacket getting out of the back, which is obviously Jack Nicholson. It's possible the movie could have kept Bromden as the narrator. Voiceover could have covered for the fact that he spends most of the story as a silent observer, and scenes that could have been framed to make the character's presence clear even when he wasn't the focus. But instead of trying to capture the novel's intensity, Forman went for more of a restrained approach. There are no grand hallucinations, no visions of the Combine that Bromden is convinced is working behind the scenes to turn everyone into programmable robots. The events of the book unfold more or less realistically, making Bromden's job as a narrator irrelevant. Mm-hmm. He's still a very important character, and gives a terrific performance by keeping his intelligence as a secret for most of the running time. The movie manages to create a powerful jolt out of the moment when he finally does talk to McMurphy.
That's an incredible moment in the movie. Whenever he,
whenever
he looks over at him.
When you don't know.
Yeah.
It's like.
What? He says, "Thank you." And he looks over at him like.
What the fuck? You just talked. What's fascinating, though, is that without Bromden at Story Center, McMurphy becomes the audience's identification figure more or less by default. Mm-hmm. Nicholson is at his peak, his jackknife charisma on display, and the outsider coming into a closed-circuit universe. We learn along with him how a ward operates and share his growing bafflement and disgust with Nurse Ratched methods. Mm-hmm. While most of the patients mentioned in the novel appear on screen, none of them get enough time to take focus. Their various nervous tics make them initially off-putting and strange, whereas McMurphy is well-adjusted and easy to understand. Mm-hmm. It's a dynamic that subtly but thoroughly changes the dichotomy of the source material. The novel lays out its case with borderline religious fervor. In Borden's eyes, McMurphy is superhuman, a giant man with a booming voice, seemingly inexhaustible lust for life, and an avatar that is all individual and righteous and masculine in the world. His battle against Ratched for the soul of the ward plays out like an epic showdown between two brilliant, near-mythic opponents. Mm-hmm. Even with the glimpses we get of McMurphy tired or acting in self-interest, they have a Christ-like feel to them, a certain Garden of Eden vibe. He struggles because whether he wants it or not, he's responsible for all of them, and in the end, he has to sacrifice himself to free them. Contrast that with the movie, where most of the running time has McMurphy acting reasonable, like any reasonable person might if they were thrown into the nut house. He treats the other inmates like regular guys and gets increasingly annoyed by their antics. Mm-hmm. He marvels at the Machiavellian horrors of the nurses' group therapy sessions, he talks with doctors, and when things start going south, he tries to escape. These are all things that happen in the novel. The only major additions are the two scenes of McMurphy in therapy, which give chance to fill in some of the backstories and his struggles with Ratched, but the tone is different, to the point where at times it hardly feels like a contest of wills at all. In the book, McMurphy bets the other patients he can get under the nurse's skin. The bet feels like an introduction of a premise. While the stakes will grow increasingly dire as time goes on, the basic hook of McMurphy versus the system lasts till the end. But while he makes the same bet in the movie, it's treated casually and essentially forgotten. The adaptation trades the ritual of tragedy. McMurphy's fate is foreshadowed by the repeated mentions of earlier disruptors in the ward who got sent for a lobotomy after causing too many problems, for something more organic and harder to parse. On the whole, it's a very smart movie. Mm-hmm. The novel's approach serves it well, but Kesey has an unfortunate tendency to let his critique of conformity and mindless automation get bagged down by the misogynistic runners about ball cutters and harridans. The women of the story are either humorless control freaks or daffy whores, and every patient in the ward seems to have suffered at the hand of one or the other. Billy, a desperately shy young man, kills himself when the nurse threatens to tell his mother he slept with a prostitute. The idea of the individual versus society is a staple of literature, and when Kesey sticks to McMurphy in his doomed efforts to beat the system, it's powerful stuff. But the weird, narrow-minded interpretation of how the system works undercuts the message. By contrast, the movie's streamlined approach chunks most of this, and as a result is something far more open to interpretation. Mm-hmm. The sexism is still there, but in terms of representation. But outside McMurphy calling Ratched a cunt, which seems pretty in character, and another patient's wife, there's very little specific talk of gender or men having their power robbed by women in their lives. Mm-hmm. What's left is a generalized sense of malaise, the horror of being inadequate to meet the demands of adult life. The mental ward of the movie feels lived in and depressed, the kind of place you go when there's no other place left. Mm-hmm. McMurphy's inspirational efforts are driven more by exasperation than any saint-like desire to improve the lives of others. There's a subtle but distinguishable arc of him being forced into helping people almost against his will, as though he's so annoyed that other people aren't able to appreciate life the way he does, he has to do something about it. Mm-hmm. This is not the end of the article, but what I think is really interesting... It's a really good article. But what I think is interesting, probably like what's interesting the most about changing that is, for one, the book kind of implies that the chief is sort of mentally ill.
Yeah, he's paranoid.
He's really, really paranoid.
But also in the book, it goes in deep into like how he was just totally just abused by it as a kid, right? Because he was Native American. And he was like on like reservation camps, mm-hmm, and stuff like that, and how horrible his childhood, yeah, was, and that's why he's paranoid.
So paranoid, right. So... the chief is mentally ill, whereas it is in the movie, you don't really see that
at all. You see that, like, he's protecting himself by being, yeah, pretending to be deaf and dumb,
yeah, you don't
as
even
they
really
say.
Know why he's there.
Yeah.
And also, I think I agree that in the movie, McMurphy, mm-hmm, McNally. McMurphy is a very selfish person.
Yes,
like, he's not a good person.
No, but
really,
you still feel bad for him.
You like him.
You do like him because he's charismatic.
And he's nice to the patient.
He treats them like people.
Right.
Which you don't see from anyone else in the entire movie. Like, Nurse Ratched does not. She treats them like animals.
Yeah, the orderlies don't treat them like people. Like, yeah, he treats them like people. So even though he's kind of a prick and he raped a 15-year-old girl, he...
Also 63, though. It's 1963.
That's true. And to be fair, in his defense, apparently she said she was 18. Don't know if that's true.
I don't know if that's true. Also, I'm just
going to say, unreliable.
It was 1963.
He's an unreliable narrator, I think, for sure.
So. Yeah.
And he clearly has a problem. He's clearly been in
trouble
with the law
before.
He
has issues with violence, but not necessarily mental illness.
Yeah, he is.
Issues with, like, impulse control, I would say.
Yes. But he is very selfish, and everything he does very selfishly.
But he's also very smart.
Yeah, oh yeah, he's not unintelligent in any way. And, like, Nurse, I don't know. It's interesting that they switch up. I think it's true that, like, I agree with this article that, like, switching up the perspective really... If it was from Chief's perspective, you wouldn't get that, like, surprise.
Exactly, whenever you find out.
Because you'd be like, oh, well, he's clearly smart. Also, I think voiceovers just very rarely should be used in films.
I agree.
They generally, in my opinion, don't add much. Mm-hmm. And so they need to be used, like, incredibly effectively.
Yeah.
And if this whole movie was, like, voiceover.
But like it is in the book.
It would be,
would
like.
Would not be good.
Annoying.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. It's interesting. So basically, they say that, you know, Nicholson, the reason that it's easy to sympathize with Murky's frustrations, so the reason it's that we like him, it's easy to sympathize with McMurphy's frustrations, but it's also possible to feel pity for Nurse Ratched, which is, this is what we've been talking about.
Yeah, we were talking about this
Nurse
earlier.
Ratched, because of this show, like, we did it because of the show.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to think about her more. I think a lot of people don't think about her
a
lot.
Yeah, I think so too.
While she encourages the bad spirits of the group and inadvertently leads to Billy's death, she's also trying to maintain order in a chaotic world, and the movie is just smart enough to recognize that that order has an appeal. The movie's main flaw comes from trying too hard to push a message across. The book is full of heavy themes, but these are filtered through Bromden's skewed perspective, and there's a coherence to their intensity. His rants about the Combine are simplistic and absurd, but they function well as characterization. Depicting Bromden as a man so broken down that he sees everything in terms of a grand conspiracy and epic adventure. He feels small, so the things he sees take on size, and as the novel progresses, McMurphy helps him regain his size. He calms down to the point where he can stand on his own. When the movie falls back into something approaching Bromden's overly stylized tone, it's unable to support it. In both versions of the story, McMurphy arranges for the patients of the ward to rent a boat and go on a fishing trip. Bromden comes along in the novel, and it's an important transitional sequence, showing how the shy, neurotic patients bloom at a chance for real freedom. The movie takes the same approach, minus Bromden, but the overly comical music and self-consciously wacky antics of the group are more cringe-inducing than charming. At one point, the men spy on McMurphy and his girl having sex in the cabin of the boat, and it's a deeply creepy moment that's played like a lighthearted goof between friends. And then there's the ending. It's one of the most enduring contributions to popular culture. McMurphy attacks Nurse Ratched in response to Billy's death. He's taken off the ward and lobotomized, and then Bromden smothers post-lobotomy Murphy in his bed, picks up the control box for the hydrotherapy system, throws it through a window, and escapes. One man must die so another may live. The system can't be defeated, but maybe with a little luck and a lot of upper body strength, it can be escaped. It's a memorable conclusion, striking a mix of despair and triumph. It's also a bit of a stretch, pushing characters to behave in ways that don't entirely fit what we know about them. The novel comes closer to carrying it off, mainly because Kesey spends a good deal of time warming us up to what's coming. There are mentions of what happened to the last patient who got under Nurse Ratched's skin. When Murphy tries to lift the control box himself, he tells others he's going to throw it through a window, just like Bromden does in the end. And most importantly, Bromden frames the big showdown between McMurphy and Nurse in a way that makes a definitive conclusion to the conflict seem unavoidable. By the end, McMurphy's barely himself anymore, trapped inside the expectations of men whose lives he's changed. His larger-than-life status a curse more than a blessing. Still, that he falls asleep on the ward instead of escaping the party he sets up specifically for the purpose doesn't make a lot of sense. It makes even less sense in the movie, where McMurphy is clearly human and clearly more eager to be off on his own. The movie's tensions between McMurphy, who wants his freedom, and the McMurphy, who kind of likes the men in the ward, is something that never really goes away. Generally, he seems more annoyed by their inability to get out of their own way than he is to inspire them. Which works well because for most of the runtime, it fits Foreman's muted Altman-esque observational approach. But in sticking to the source material's endings, which is admittedly so iconic you couldn't really change it, the movie betrays the more complex version of McMurphy that Nicholson works to create, even if it tries to justify the decision. There's a lovely close-up of him near the end of the party after everyone is left alone and he's wanting to go. His face is still, and for a moment, some of the exhaustion Bromden talks about in the novel comes across, as though some part of him realizes that no matter how hard he tries, he's not going to be able to get away. In deciding to give Billy some time alone with a pretty woman, he's lost his chance for freedom. It's not enough to make everything else plausible, but it's something. Foreman tries to wring out some suspense, but giving McMurphy one last chance to escape the next morning, but by the time he's being led back into the ward with twin lobotomy scars on his forehead, any subtlety or ambiguity is lost. In both versions, the finale feels a little too designed, a little too definitive, and the image of Bromden finally escaping into the wild is hard to resist. It's a twist that requires a certain willing suspension of disbelief on the part of the audience, but in both cases, considerable ground is made towards earning that disbelief. At least it makes for an excellent title. So, I don't know that I agree that, like, the lobotomy thing is unbelievable.
I don't think it's unbelievable, mainly, really.
Mainly because if you know about how mental health patients were treated in, like, the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
That's actually, like, kind of, I'm almost surprised they didn't do it sooner.
Yeah, I'm surprised they didn't do it sooner or more.
Yeah.
Because they were throwing those things around like hotcakes back then.
Truly, truly. You could
they were, like, they were, like, throwing them out of freaking t-shirt cannons.
You could literally just, like, go get your wife lobotomized if she was, like, having a bad day.
Exactly, yeah. You literally could do that.
You didn't need to prove that she was,
she's
like,
crying. All right.
Yeah, it's like, this guy has some serious impulse control issues. Yeah. Anyone would have given that man a lobotomy in a second.
Oh, yeah.
It's true that it does happen fast.
It does,
like,
yeah.
It goes from he's crazy to they get electroshock therapy to, like, he's lobotomized. Yeah. And it's like, whoa, we didn't even try anything else. Mm-hmm.
But that's pretty accurate, I would say, to the 50s and 60s, the way mental health was practiced.
Yeah, lobotomies back then were, like, literally seen as, like, a cure-all.
Oh, yeah.
Like, anyone that has problem behavior, you can just give them this and suddenly they'll be all better. And it's like,
and this is my sociology professor, we talked about this movie a lot and about how it really changed the way people view the mentally ill in our country. Mm-hmm. Because this is the first book, the first, like, movie, and it was so well done that everyone, you know, would watch it, and Jack Nicholson, obviously.
Right.
And so everyone saw it, and it was the first movie that really showed psychiatric patients as the protagonists and, you know, the nurses as the antagonists and showed you that, like, maybe these people should be treated like people. Maybe we shouldn't be cutting out parts of their brain.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting is you can just see, like, in even, like, I don't want to say, like, Billy, because he's fine.
He just has a stutter.
He has a stutter.
And he's anxious.
But look at, like, Danny DeVito's character, like, Martini.
Yeah.
This is someone who clearly is, like,
he's pretty nonverbal.
Very mentally ill.
Very, like, pretty obviously low IQ.
Yeah, like, he's the kind of person that, like, really actually does kind of need to be in, like, a home.
Yeah.
And at that time, this is the home.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, exactly.
There are no homes. There's, like, no assisted living facilities. There's this mental institution.
Yeah, exactly.
He does need to be here. Like, the rest of these people that we see don't really need to be here, but he does.
Yeah, definitely.
And
he, like, doesn't really understand a lot of things, and
but you can even see, like, just from letting him go out and have some fun and treating him more like a person, how much better he does.
How much better he does, yeah, exactly.
How much, like, more he's a, how much easier it is for him to calm down, how much easier it is for him to recognize kind of what's real and what's not, versus, and I mean, I think a lot of that is, like, mental stimulation is important.
Yeah, you can't just sit people in, you know, the same room all day and expect them to get better.
Yeah. And that's something that's interesting. And the thing is, this came out in the 70s.
75.
So, yeah, mid-70s. By this point, the kind of, like, exposing of mental asylums had already happened.
Yeah, there towards was, like, the end of the 60s.
Yeah, that was, like, a big, wasn't there, like, a, I believe there was, like, a big news story.
Yeah, 1 second.
I know that this is a historical thing.
Yeah, give me 1 second. I know what it's called, but I can't think about it. It's set, like, I always get it mixed up with the American Horror Story Asylum.
I know.
It's not Briarcliff, but it's, like, very similar.
They based it on the real thing.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why I always get it mixed up.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Let's see. Willowbrook.
Willowbrook. When was that? When did that happen?
Let's see. It operated until 1987.
Wow.
But let's see when the actual,
the,
like,
story,
the story took place. About 1965.
Okay. This book was written in 1962.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. But yeah, in 1965, there was that really big
story where they went in and, like, saw the horrible conditions that all these people were living in.
This is from the Wikipedia article about scandals and abuses of the Willowbrook. So in 1965, Willowbrook housed over 6,000 intellectually disabled people, despite having a maximum capacity of 4,000.
Yeah.
Senator Robert F. Kennedy toured the institution in 1965 and proclaimed that individuals in the overcrowded facility were living in filth and dirt, their clothing in rags, in rooms less comfortable and cheerful than the cages in which we put animals in a zoo,
mm-hmm.
and offered a series of recommendations for improving conditions. Although the hepatitis study had been discontinued... What was that? I'll read that in a second.
Oh, they were infecting
people with
hepatitis.
Wow.
Yeah, we learned about that in one of my classes.
Wow. The residence school's reputation was that of a warehouse for New York City's mentally disabled people, many of whom were presumably abandoned there by their families, foster care agencies, or other systems designed to care for them. Donna Stone, an advocate for mentally disabled children as well as victims of child abuse, gained access to the school by posing as a recent social work graduate.
Mm-hmm.
She then shared her observations with members of the press. A series of articles in local newspapers, including Staten Island Advance and the Staten Island Register, described the crowded, filthy living conditions at Willowbrook and the negligent treatment of some of its residents. Jane Curtin was the first reporter to write a story about Willowbrook State School after she visited Willowbrook in order to cover a demonstration that social work and parents of the residents had organized. Curtin wanted to get inside the building, and social workers Elizabeth Lee and Ira Fisher brought her inside. Shortly thereafter, in early 1972, Geraldo Rivera, an investigative reporter in New York...
Geraldo, sorry.
Conducted a series of investigations at Willowbrook, uncovering a host of deplorable conditions. So this is even...
Later.
The 72. After they've been caught the first
72.
Time. Yeah.
So, like, the big thing would happen in 72, but they started...
In 1965, Robert Kennedy, the senator of New York...
Yeah.
...knew that this was happening. And... told them they needed to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it had already been in the press, like local press. So, including overcrowding, inadequate sanitary facilities, and physical and sexual abuse of residents by members of the school staff. The expose, entitled Willowbrook, The Last Great Disgrace, garnered national attention and won a Peabody Award for Rivera.
Mm-hmm.
Rivera appeared on The Dick Cavett Show with film of patients at the school. As a result, the overcrowding and inhumane conditions, a class action lawsuit was filed against the state of New York by the parents of 5,000 residents of Willowbrook in federal court in March 1972. This was known as New York ARC versus Rockefeller. Elizabeth Lee's employment was terminated in 1972 as a result of her activism. In 1975, a consent judgment was signed, and it committed New York State to improve community placement for the new, now-designated Willowbrook class. The publicity generated by the case was a major contributing factor to the passage of a federal law, the Civil Rights of Institutionalized Persons Act of 1980.
Wow. It's so crazy that this book was written in 1963.
And then
1962. And then the movie was made in 1975.
So you've got 1962, 3 years before this even happens.
Yeah.
We're like, this is not good.
Yeah.
Then...
The expose comes out in 72.
The expose comes out, and 3 years later, they turn this into a movie the same year that they rule in favor.
Yeah. Really timely.
Really timely. I mean, I think that's a big... It's no doubt that there's a reason this movie was so interesting.
Yeah.
Because it came out at the perfect time.
And because people were like, I have no idea what happens in psychiatric hospitals.
Well, you maybe heard about this Willowbrook thing.
Yeah.
Like, the book comes out, it does okay, it does pretty well. Mm-hmm. But, you know, people don't read that much.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
People read more back then, but not, you know. And then you've got this big, huge scandal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of like a little bit of a rumbling, and Robert F. Kennedy's going to like, oh, this isn't good. And you're like, okay, but then it goes away.
But then like 5 years later.
And then suddenly there's footage on the Dick Cavett Show of this disgusting.
Yeah.
And you see it. And then 3 years later... You get to go. I think here's the thing. Making McNally kind of
McMurphy.
Or McMurphy, damn it. Making McMurphy like the narrator is like a good idea.
I think so too.
Because it's a lot easier for a person to identify with him. And,
yeah, because he's not mentally ill.
Right, and go through kind of, like, see how bad it is.
And see, like, understanding, like, oh, he's treating these people like they're people.
Right. Well, I'm feeling like that I could do that.
Yeah.
Like,
that I could be in that situation. Especially, yeah. Like, men in, like, in 1975, they could be like, oh, yeah.
Yeah. So,
like, I'm violent. I had sex with a 15-year-old.
As a lot of men were.
As a lot of men were at the time.
Yeah, I mean, it's a super timely piece.
Yeah, and also timeless.
Timeless. Timely, timeless.
Timely, timeless. I have
do we want to talk about Ratched?
Oh, I have, like, more stuff.
Oh, damn.
I have quite a bit more stuff. I have a whole Mental Floss article.
Sweet.
That I'm not going to read the entire thing because it's not that interesting. Let's see. One studio wanted to change the ending. When producers were shopping the picture to studios, 20th Century Fox was interested, but with a catch. Fox would distribute the film, but only if the filmmakers would agree to rewrite the ending. The studio wanted McMurphy to live. The producers wisely considered this a deal breaker, and United Arts eventually distributed the film.
Yeah, smart.
Jack Nicholson and Louise Fletcher were not the first choices for their characters. When Kirk Douglas spearheaded the first attempt to bring One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest to life on the big screen in the 1960s, he had intended to play the Randall and Patrick McMurphy role himself, just as he had on stage. When production began in earnest 10 years later, Douglas was too old for the part, leaving director Foreman to consider and contact the likes of Gene Hackman, Marlon Brando, and his personal favorite, Burt Reynolds, before finally settling on Jack Nicholson. Settle for Jack Nicholson.
Settle
okay.
For Jack Nicholson.
In the set, like, I don't think anyone can settle for Jack Nicholson when he was at his top in the 70s.
Oh, yeah. 70s and 80s were Jack Nicholson's peak.
Incredible actor. Louise Fletcher, who played Ratched, her view changed Foreman's view on the character. Foreman's original view of Nurse Ratched was the personification of evil, a characterization that made Louise Fletcher a bad fit for the part of the film in the filmmaker's mind. As Fletcher pressed for the role, Foreman's perspective of Ratched evolved. I slowly started to realize that it would be much more powerful if it's not this visible evil, that she's only an instrument of evil. She doesn't know that she's evil. She, as a matter of fact, believes she's helping people. This new take on the character paved the way for the official casting of Fletcher.
Mm-hmm.
Several of the film stars were not actors, including Chief. The stars lived in the ward during production. All of the actors who played patients actually lived on the Oregon State Hospital psychiatric ward throughout production. Wild. This would never happen now.
No, literally never. Can you imagine, literally, you're a filmmaker, you go up to someone, like, it's a mental ward. People live there.
Yeah.
And you're like, hey, can I live here to shoot my movie? They'd be like, no.
No, but it was 75. And they were like, yeah.
Sure. They were like, hey, we just stopped sexually assaulting them.
So, like, yeah.
So, sure.
Sure.
I don't care what you do.
Many scenes were shot without the actor's knowledge. To complete this realistic immersion, Foreman led his performers in unscripted group therapy sessions in which he directed the actors to develop their characters' psychological maladies organically.
That's cool.
He would often capture footage of the actors, both in and out of character, without explicitly mentioning that the cameras were rolling. The film's final cut includes a shot of a visibly irritated Fletcher reacting to a piece of direction fed to her by Foreman. Foreman and Nicholson had a tremendous spat over the film's plot. While the intensity of the turmoil varies from rumor to rumor, reports from the set were consistent on one fact. The star refused to speak with Foreman for a large chunk of the production process. Nicholson took issue with Foreman's suggestion that the hospital inmates would be an unruly bunch upon the initial arrival of McMurphy. Instead, the actor insisted that such disavowal of the medical staff's authority should only begin after the introduction of McMurphy into their lives and routines. So that was their issue. Danny DeVito created an imaginary friend during production. Emotionally strained by a demanding shooting schedule that kept him 3,000 miles away from his future wife, Rhea Perlman, DeVito developed the coping mechanism of an imaginary friend with whom he would have nightly chats. Concerned that his own sanity might be slipping away, DeVito sought the advice of Dr. Brooks, who assured him that there was no reason to worry as long as DeVito could still identify the character as fictional. Where is this one? Sorry. Ah. Okay. I got lost.
It's okay.
The crew was worried about the sanity of one cast member. While Dr. Brooks had no concerns about DeVito, he echoed the rest of the cast and crew's apprehensions about the psychological state of Sidney Lassick, who played Charlie Cheswick. Lassick exhibited increasingly unpredictable and emotional erratic behavior during his time as his character, a pattern that culminated in a tearful outburst during his observation of the final scene between Nicholson and Sampson. Lassick became so overwhelmed during the scene that he had to be removed from set.
Holy shit! Mm-hmm.
This is the craziest thing that is, like, the most 1970s thing I have ever heard in my entire life. Okay. Envious of the camaraderie her male co-stars had forged, and hoping to dispel any associations with her tyrannical character, Fletcher surprised the cast one evening by ripping off her dress on the crowded ward. Years later, the actress laughed about this display, saying, "I'll show them. I'm a real woman under there, you know. I think that must have been what I was thinking."
And they were all like, "What the fuck, Louise? Hey, what's going on? Louise, it's not gonna happen. We have all of the scenes. We have like 5 scenes with you. We got like 20 with each other." Louise, so, like, I'm the only girl. I want to hang too. I like to be a part of the group.
Not since 1934's It Happened One Night swept the Oscars had a film walked away with awards for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, Best Actress, and Best Adapted Screenplay. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest took home the lot, with Nicholson and Fletcher winning the top acting awards. The feat would not be matched again for another 16 years, with Silence of the Lambs becoming the next and last to date movie to earn the distinction.
Very good.
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest was revered worldwide, but Swedish viewers developed an especially soft spot for the film. Cuckoo's Nest remained a regular option for Swedish moviegoers through 1987, 11 years after its initial release.
Jeez,
I know. Kesey, the writer, refused to see the film, but he may have by accident. The poster child for the book was better. Movement. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest author Kesey disapproved of a big screen adaptation of his novel as soon as he found out that the filmmakers had abandoned the use of Chief Bromden as the story's narrator.
It's hard to use. It is hard. It's hard.
Kesey never intended to see the movie, but one story says he inadvertently caught a few moments during a bout of channel surfing one evening. Once Kesey realized what he was watching, he promptly changed stations.
Watch it, bro.
I know.
It's good.
So that's from a Mental Floss article. And then I also have some trivia.
Okay.
Many extras were authentic mental patients. Again, no! Could never be done now.
No. Yeah, definitely not. Would not be able to.
This is really interesting. Will Sampson, who played Chief Bromden, mm-hmm. was a park ranger in Oregon near when the film was being made. He was selected for the part because he was the only Native American the casting department could find who matched the character's incredible size.
They're like, "Hey, you want to be in a movie?
You're like a main character.
You don't have to talk very much.
But you're like a main character.
But like, we'll pay you good."
Dean R. Brooks was a psychiatrist and director of the Oregon State Hospital where the film was made. During filming, Dr. Brooks correctly diagnosed William Redfield with leukemia and would kill him 18 months later. William Redfield played, who did he play? Let's see. Dale Harding.
The gay guy?
Yeah. He died of leukemia 18 months later.
Can you imagine? You're on set.
Yeah.
You're filming. Mm-hmm. And you're just talking to the guy that owns this hospital, and you guys start becoming friends, and then he's like, "Bro,
I think you have leukemia.
And you're like, "What?" And then he's like, yeah, bro. And then you die
18 months later.
Oh, that's heavy. That's a heavy thing to learn while filming.
Yeah. Louise Fletcher was so disturbed by her own performance that she couldn't watch it for the film for years. In later interviews, Louise Fletcher said that she found ways to make her character human, yet remain unsympathetic. Ultimately deciding that Nurse Ratched actually did care about the patients and felt she was doing what was best for them, but was ultimately misguided and drunk on her own power.
Yeah, I agree with that.
This is insane. This is 70 shit. Okay, during filming, the crew member running cables left a second-story window open at the Oregon State Mental Hospital, and an actual patient climbed through the bars and fell to the ground, injuring himself. The next day, the Statesman Journal in Salem, Oregon, reported this incident with the headline on the front page, "One Flew Out of the Cuckoo's Nest."
Oh my god.
Isn't that insane?
This is why you're not allowed to film in a mental ward.
Yeah.
And it being used.
Yeah. Many of the cast members stayed in character even when the cameras weren't rolling. Even during the first time Jack Nicholson arrived on set, he was disturbed by how realistic the rest of the cast was. He ran outside and asked, did they ever break character?
Jack Nicholson's like, what? Are we method?
Are we? What is going on? I wasn't method.
I wasn't aware.
Jack Nicholson took a percentage of the profits in lieu of a small salary for a modestly budgeted film. The movie paid off when the picture went on to gross well over $120
million. Smart. Yeah, smart. This movie, the budget for this movie was only $3 million.
Yeah.
So super small.
The title derives from an American child's folk rhyme. It can be read in its entirety in the novel. I think it's like, one flew east, one flew west, one flew over the cuckoo's nest, I think is what it goes.
Yes.
Let's see, there was one more that I had, and it was about Danny DeVito. Oh, Danny DeVito was the first actor to be cast in this movie because he played the role of Martini in the 1971 stage adaptation.
Yes.
And also, there was one more fact about Danny DeVito because I love him so much. I think it was during the boat scene that they got like lost out, that caught out there in the ocean, and they took them like 3 days to film, and then they got all... Everyone except Jack Nicholson got so sick on the boat, and Danny DeVito that says he's like, if I watch the movie, I can't watch that scene because I just get like nauseous.
Oh my gosh, that's awful. I know. That sounds horrible.
It's so funny because I saw this movie after I had already watched a lot of Always Sunny in Philadelphia, so yeah. It's always very fun seeing like, is that Frank Reynolds?
Why is he doing this? He's a little baby Frank Reynolds.
He's a little baby. He's so tiny.
This is really... A really good movie.
What would you give it?
Oh, a 10 out of
10. 10 out of 10.
It's excellent.
It's excellent.
It's an excellent movie.
It's classic. It's incredible. Everything about it is just amazing.
Let's talk about, we kind of talked about it a little bit, but like Nurse Ratched.
Yeah.
I feel like when people talk about like evil characters.
Yeah, they're like
they
Nurse
always
Ratched.
Are like Nurse Ratched, evil, evil, evil. And you're like,
I don't really think so.
I don't really think so either. You know, the more I like watch this movie, the more I'm like, she is passive aggressive.
Oh yeah, and like.
She
is not doing the best job.
No, and she's certainly, like, on a bit of a power trip.
Definitely.
And she definitely doesn't see these people as, like, fully people.
Yeah.
But, like, that's not that uncommon of a thought process.
In 1963.
No, it wouldn't have been an uncommon thought process.
No, not at all.
Like, this is exactly how a lot of people would have treated patients. And, think about Westbrook.
Yeah.
People were physically and sexually abusing the patients, literally letting them live in their own shit.
Yeah.
Like, for years. And, like, we want to talk about Nurse Ratched being evil. Nurse Ratched made sure they got pills.
Yeah.
Nurse Ratched was doing treatments on people that were condoned by medical boards at the time.
Mm-hmm.
She took their cigarettes away, sure, but because they were losing them all... To a guy who she knew wasn't mentally ill.
Yeah.
Here's what you kind of have to understand is Jack Nicholson's character is
McMurphy.
McMurphy is in this ward.
Because he's violent.
Because he's violent and he's super charismatic.
Yeah.
He's rambunctious. He's getting all these patients super riled up. People who we see in the very first scene are very easily riled up.
Yes.
By like a
but
bunch.
Also, they're not doing anything all they're day, so of course they are.
Exactly. Yeah, they got a lot of energy to pent up.
Yeah.
And so he's riling up these patients. He's causing a lot of disorder. He's getting people to not take their medication. Mm-hmm. He's getting people to break the rules. He's getting people to fight Nurse Ratched, which is annoying. He's also, on top of that, he's taking their cigarettes by like, he's playing them in card games. He's totally conning them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, he's having fun, and we don't mind it because it's good, lighthearted fun, and he's nice to them.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, ultimately, like, if you're Nurse Ratched, you see this guy who's getting out of a prison sentence mm-hmm. by pretending to be insane.
Yeah.
When you can clearly see that he's not.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's coming and fucking with your patients.
Yeah.
Like, you're not gonna be nice to this guy.
You're not gonna be happy.
You're not gonna be nice to this guy. And, like, here's really where I think people think Nurse Ratched is evil. The fact is, Nurse Ratched knows he's not crazy.
Yeah. But she lobotomizes him anyway.
And she lobotomizes him anyway. And that's fucked up.
That is fucked up.
But
also, no one should be lobotomized.
No one should be lobotomized. But the fact is, what is really fucked up is we know that Nurse Ratched knows that he's not crazy.
Yeah.
And she still does it just to get him to stop.
Yeah.
And we know that because they kind of make fun of him for being like, you know you're never going to get to leave here.
Yeah.
Because he because that basically that part where he learns that, that this isn't a temporary sentence if you're criminally insane. But also, this is still just the trial period.
Mm-hmm.
She lies to the judge saying that she lies on his evaluation saying he is criminally insane, mm-hmm. knowing that he's not, because she wants to punish him.
Yep.
And that's really where she gets evil. But it's really her going on a power trip. And true, probably what she should have done is just been like, he's not insane, get him back to prison.
Yeah, take him back to prison.
But
she wanted to, you know, go to the full extent of her power.
Exactly. And on top of that, maybe that's what she would have done originally, but a lot has changed. Billy's dead now.
Because of her. Yeah.
Basically, because of her. Because
she guilted him.
She has nearly been killed by this guy.
Mm-hmm.
She's lost a considerable amount of power because of him, and it's going to be impossible to ever get that back.
Yeah.
So it's like, it does kind of feel like it needs a definitive ending. Because if he just goes back to prison, it's like, well, she's not any better off.
Yeah. Ugh, just such a heartbreaking ending.
It's a heartbreaking ending.
Chief.
But I don't think Nurse Ratched is evil. It'll be interesting to see in this new show. Because Ryan Murphy is obviously kind of known for these more... I mean, he's definitely done stuff that's not horror, but he's known for American Horror Story.
Yeah.
He's known for horror.
Yeah, definitely.
And Sarah Paulson and Ryan Murphy are known for horror.
Both of them.
So it'll be interesting to see if if it's going to be like horror?
Yeah.
Or if it's going to be like a complex look at
the character.
Nurse Ratched. Yeah. It'll be interesting.
I really don't know what to expect either.
I kind of don't know what I would want.
I don't know either.
We'll see how it goes.
Yeah, we'll see.
Okay.
So, what would you give this movie? 10 out of 10.
Oh, I said 10 out of 10.
Cool.
Okay, so here's the review. 1 out of 10. I think I actually have two, but I think I'm only going to read this one. 1 out of 10. Mick Murphy and the Chief. A fatal misunderstanding. The Chief kills Mick Murphy because he thinks he's ignoring him. Shocking. Your face.
What?
Also.
What?
As an... Oh, what's those people that study birds? Ornithologist. I study birds. All manner of birds. Especially cuckoos. This movie... This movie didn't have a single cuckoo. What a crashing disappointment. All I got instead was a bunch of lunatics running around and making silly noises at each other for 2 hours. Did he think this was going to be about birds? It's cuckoo because cuckoo is something people used to say for like when people were crazy.
Yeah.
One flew over the cuckoo's nest. He goes insane.
Yeah.
That's the thing. That's the thing. That's why.
Yeah.
It's not actually about birds. This isn't like, what is it, vivarium?
Yes.
It's not like vivarium where the cuckoo is like a symbol. With a title this misleading, the film should be scorned. I waited and waited to catch a glimpse of at least one cuckoo, but nothing happened. There's nothing about cuckoos in this at all. It's not about cuckoos, if you guys don't know. They're birds that
lay their eggs in other birds' nests, and then once the big cuckoo bird like breaks open and is born, it kicks all the other eggs out of the nest and kills them so that the host bird feeds it all the food.
It's like a parasite bird.
Yeah. So the cuckoos don't have to raise their own kids.
But clearly, you see that that's not what's happening here. Cuckoo is being used as crazy. A cuckoo's nest is the mental ward.
Yes.
It's not actually about a cuckoo
bird.
Metaphorical. Metaphorical. Truly. And with cuckoo meaning crazy.
Yes.
So instead, I witnessed some ridiculous scene in which McMurphy ignores a big chief and is killed with a pillow for doing so. I like how he says ignored.
He has a lobotomy!
Maybe this man didn't get that. Maybe he didn't know what lobotomies were.
Yeah.
So he was like, what's wrong
with
it?
They show the scars.
Yeah, but maybe he doesn't know. Maybe he's just like, what happened to his head? What? I didn't realize that was there before. Why are they zooming in on it? Not a bird in sight. At the end, some Indian guy runs off into the woods. Still, I waited for a glimpse of at least one bird. Nothing. How anyone can call a bunch of maniacs drooling and farting entertainment, I'll never know. This person thought this was going to be a movie about birds. And he's an ornithologist, so he was so excited.
That is so...
How do you not know what this movie is going to be about? Well, this review had to have been written post-internet. Yeah, 2008. Yeah. So how did you not know that this wasn't about birds? Oh, boy. I was like, wow.
That's insane. There's not a single cuckoo.
With a title this misleading, you're like, so the movie was good, but you were mad because there were no birds? This is a guy that loves birds. Loves his job. His favorite bird is the cuckoo.
Oh, yeah.
And he's upset. He thought he was coming to see a movie about cuckoo birds, and instead he got Jack Nicholson giving the performance of a lifetime.
You know...
I'm upset!
I didn't want to see this Oscar-winning performance.
I wanted to see birds! You're like, okay, all buddy. Right. Sorry.
Okay. Alright, guys.
I looked up the synopsis.
So, watch The Devil All the Time and donate to our Patreon.
Yep.
And then you can get on Peacock and watch Do the Right Thing.
And it's completely free.
Yeah.
All right, guys.
Thanks, guys.
Bye.